Now it's time to be educated and entertained by the country's most famous environmental scientist, Joey Bia's research grizzly bears, wolves, and birds of prey. He continues to travel all across America to bring you the very best that nature has to offer. Be ready to be amazed. Here's your host, Joey B.
Hello and welcome to Joey B. Outdoor Science and Nature. Man, do I have the coolest job. I travel all across America to bring you the very best that nature has to offer. The title of today's show is Life in the Organic Garden, and I am going to welcome right now my great friend, Inspector Dave. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Joey B. Always a pleasure to be on the podcast.
Well, you know, Inspector Dave, we always talk about it this way. We'd rather be recording in the garden, but via all this COVID, we're here in the studio, or actually, I say, we're recording via Zoom. Today's recording will not be the same quality as the sound that we typically have in the studio, but I have recorded Zoom podcast shows. It's pretty good. So you're nice and clear. How do I sound to you?
You sound wonderful as always.
I appreciate that. So the way I looked at life in the garden, because we want to talk organics today, I was going to talk about the good that's going on in your garden. Then we'll talk about the bad, including pest control, things like that. And then there's some other factors that people just need to know in regard to how do you run a successful garden. So let's go to the good right now, Inspector Dave. And we're going to talk early spring. So what are some of the things that you've done either to prepare or you did early spring?
Well, early spring is when we got all the beds ready to go. We rototilled, added some amendments, our green sand and our compost from our compost bins. And we let that all work for about a month or so. And then we started getting all our drip lines in place and our different color plastic mulches that we use, and was preparing all the beds for the eventual planting of all the crops.
So what were the first crops that you planted?
Well, the very first thing is sugar snap peas. Boy, there's nothing like those. So we started those, and we started some lettuce, and we started arugula.
Well, you know, it's funny, and you spoke about those sugar snap peas. They are absolutely one of my favorites. So I never mind raiding your organic garden for some of those great sugar snaps. And you used a specific lettuce this year that, again, it's already 90 degrees here in the Northeast, and that lettuce is still producing. Some of it wants to bolt. Which lettuce are you using?
Well, we have two different ones we did this year. The first is a black seeded Simpson, which is an 1870 heirloom variety that is bolt resistant and heat resistant. It's a loose leaf type lettuce. And then we did Outrageous, which is a red romaine that is also heat loving and a semi savory. So we really picked the best two lettuces to use this year because it got hot fairly early and then it cooled off, then it got hot again. But the lettuce was the best I've ever seen this year.
Yeah, no, that's, and you know something, and I know that you always tell me that you're having some great sandwiches at lunch, putting the lettuces on it. For me, lunch and dinner, that black seeded Simpson and the red romaine, they're just great, great lettuces. So here's my question now, because you alluded to the colored plastic. What are the reasons why you use plastic?
The reason I use that is there's several reasons. First is weed control, because it helps to suppress the weeds by blocking the ultraviolet light that allows that to germinate. Second is it helps to control moisture, because I have the drip lines underneath all that, so I have to control the moisture so it doesn't evaporate, so it keeps me on an even keel with all the moisture requirements for our plants. And there's a little bit of critter control that goes on. The critters don't like to walk on that. It's kind of unnatural. But the biggest thing is the colors fool the plants. They allow the plants to, the sun to absorb the rays and reflect it back into the plant, so the plant thinks it has competition. So we use red, green, brown, and we're playing with the blue this year by the cucumbers. And the whole idea is it just accelerates the crops and the growing of them, and the plants, the fruiting starts much earlier. And if it's cool out, it helps to warm the soil also.
Well, I think in early spring, that is an important thing, heating up the soil so that when you do get to your planting, you might be able to plant an extra week early because the soil temps are now a little higher too, correct?
That's correct. It allows for a quicker germination of the seeds.
That is awesome. Now, you had a great fun surprise in your garden this year. Why don't you tell people what that was?
Well, over the last several years, we had had a honeybee colony in the yard, and it was great watching them and having them all working in the garden. But then about three, 4 years ago, we had some really, really tough winters, and a lot of the bees in the area all died off, including the colony that I have, so we were not able to revive it. And there was not a lot of swarming going on, which is a splitting up of bee colonies into separate families that go on to other places. So my beekeeper was unable to provide another family in there. So the box just sat vacant for a few years. And my neighbor called me about 2 months ago. He said, I just saw this big cloud of bees was in the yard. I don't know what that's all about. So I went out to see if there was a bee swarm in the area. And they had moved back into this vacant beehive that I had there all on their own. So I called my bee guy up, Jim, and I told him, come on over, Jim. We need to get the bee colony all shaped up again and get their housing all shaped up because it had been vacant and run down. Just like a house, you leave it vacant for a while, you have to kind of restore it. So we went in there and we looked at all the, we made some videos too that are we can watch on the Facebook page. And they all have, the bees are just incredibly strong. We've been playing with the hive, rebuilding some of the frames for inside there because the supplies have been very low for rebuilding. And it turns out that this year, the swarming of bees has just been incredible. He's already picked up 20 or 25 new swarms to replace all the ones that he lost over the last several years. So it's just a great year. And the bees, it's a very docile queen that we have. So it's a very nice family of bees that's out there. They're very peaceful and calm, and they're working like crazy. I'm looking at them now, and it's a sunny day, and they're working like mad out there, you know, bringing in the pollen and water.
Well, two things I thought was interesting. One was, when beekeeper Jim was in there working on your hive, you were videotaping and I was shooting some photography of it. And that was just, it's spectacular to see a professional beekeeper at work. That was one of the real cool things. And then the other thing was one day, I guess it was after some work, I came down the road to your house. We sat in the back with a adult beverage sitting there, but I was watching the bees. And they just kept going to, you have the bird baths, and it was amazing to see how many bees went to your bird bath and the importance of water for bees.
Yes, we had a little bit of a drought condition here for a while. It was very, very dry for about a month, and the bees need the water to help convert the pollen and make their wax for the combs and all inside the hive. So they had water carriers. That was their assignment. They were the water carriers, and they were zooming back and forth between the two bird baths, bringing water into the hive there so they would have the moisture for the queen and for the workers that were inside, building out their little rooms there and decorating. And it's, if you do have a bee colony nearby, it's important to have these water supplies so the neighbors won't have bees coming into their pool, because the bees are going to start looking for water anywhere, and you don't really want the neighbors to have a lot of bees flying in their pool all day long so they get mad at you. So we make sure we keep plenty of water available right near the hive so they don't have to fly too far to bring that moisture back into the hive.
No, that's a cool thing. So, and it really is. So before we get into the crops that you're growing this year and success ratios with all that, you use a unique system. You have a gravity-fed drip irrigation system. Why don't you just give a brief synopsis so people understand really what that is?
Okay, I have rain barrels on the house, and I catch all the rainwater that's naturally occurring. And then I pump it out to barrels that are on a rack, and they're about 4 or 5 feet high, which gives it pressure now from gravity by being up higher than the garden. And then I have lines that come out of those barrels, and they feed subsurface irrigation tubing that goes down the bed. So it's a Tyvek type hose that I get out of a Canadian company, Irrigrow, and they drip. It just drips all the time underneath the plastic, and it keeps the ground wet. And it's supposed to be working at the same transpiration rate as the plant. So it really gives a really, really good, even type of moisture out there. And I'm using rainwater, so it's a naturally occurring, non-treated water that's being fed to the plants there. It's a wonderful system. I've probably used it for like 30 years now. And it takes a little time to set up in the winter, in the springtime. But once I get it set up, it's all the watering's on autopilot, and it's just a wonderful thing.
Well, something to think about with that is, because if you do have a garden, it's either you get someone to take care of your garden. As you know, I have my watering girl when I leave here. She takes care of my home. But with your system, you'd be able to go away for 3-4 days at a clip and never have to worry about watering your garden because you have the plastic mulch, which is keeping the moisture in, and then you have your gravity-fed system. So I think that's pretty awesome.
Yes, now, yes.
Here is going to be my question to you. Now we'll go to, I will say, all the crops that you have in your garden, and we're going to have a little discussion about the successes on some of them, or if you ran into a few problems with any of them. So where do you, first, is there a specific place, because you will get some plants from chiliplants.com, and I know that, Cross Country Nursery. And then the other thing is, you order some from another company. Where do you, if you're growing from seed, where do you get your seed?
Well, I order from two different companies. And when I pick my companies, I always make sure that they're offering organic seeds and they've taken this safe seed pledge, which means there are no GMOs. So no, in their seed production, which means that there's no genetically modified seeds that they offer. So it's a safer type of seed because we're still not quite 100% sure on GMOs, how they can affect us long term. So I use a Pine Tree Garden Seeds and Vermont Bean Seed Company are my two main suppliers of my seeds.
So now that we know that, let's get into your garden. And one of the highly successful things I've seen this year are your bush beans. Why don't you tell me about them?
Okay, bush beans are just a fairly easy crop to grow. It's great if you have kids that you want to get interested in gardening because they have a relatively short production time. So within 50 days or so, you may be able to start picking beans. And, you know, kids have short attention spans and they get anxious about things growing. So throw a few beans in there. They're easy to grow, easy to pick. They're tasty. Most people like them. You can use them in so many different ways, raw in salads or cooked in all types of different meals, or just steamed plain, or they can be processed and frozen. So we do the bush beans because they're just easier. I don't think assemble any trellises or make any bean poles or do any of that. So we have, it's been an exceptional year for beans. Some years seem to be better than others. It's just been a great growing season for the beans, and we've been picking them already for a couple of weeks.
So what specific beans are you using this year?
So when I pick my bean seeds, and there's a lot of different varieties of beans, so you have to decide, you want yellow, you want green, you want purple, you want mottled, you know, there's so many different ones, there's short, there's long. So I pick them for, I look at the disease package first that's there, the disease resistance that they have, because beans can be subject to different diseases. So if we get a strong seed, a strong plant variety, then we know that we at least don't have to fight disease and we can keep growing lots of beans. So Annihilator is one type. Cherokee is the second one. And Provider. So that gives me a mixture of yellow and green. So it's pretty in the salads or when you're cooking with them. And each one has a slightly different time of maturity, so it spreads out the harvest a little bit. So I do two things to spread out the harvest. One, I stagger the planting a couple weeks apart, you know, put seed in, and three varieties each time, so I get like a double stagger there, so I can get maybe a very long season of beans. And then the reason that you want to keep your beans providing long term is to pick them whenever you can. Get out there, pick them when they're smaller so the plant will keep producing. Because remember, a plant's always trying to go to seed. And as soon as it goes to seed, it says, oh, I finished my job and I'm done. So you want to keep fooling it by harvesting the fruit off the plant. So beans especially, the more you pick, the more they'll keep going. Just stay away from the plants when it's wet. You should not work among the plants when it's wet because that can help spread disease. And that's probably most plants. That's a good rule to follow.
All right, good, because we're going to get to disease later on. And here's one neat thing. As you're discussing the taste, Well, I get some of your beans, and then we'll talk later on about some of your peppers, but I take your Hungarian peppers, and that is one of my salads every single evening, is just mixing those two, vinegar and oil, fresh, and they're great. And then if I'm sautéing up some vegetables, I'll also sauté some of those bush beans in, you know, whatever type of vegetables, and that's also another great simple way. See, people are getting cooking tips here on Life in the Garden as well, so this is a good thing. Now, let's go to what I think, I could be wrong, because I know you love the sugar snap peas, but I think corn is your favorite from the garden. So tell me about the corn in your garden this year.
Well, the corn that we grow is a super sweet type. It's from Super Seedware is the developer of it. And it's a bicolor, so it's white and yellow corn. So it's the best of two worlds. And it's a hybrid. And it has to be isolated. But it is such a great corn. I've been using it now for about 5 years because it germinates well. Almost 100% of the seed germinates, and in cold soil, it'll germinate. The plant stalks are super strong, so it can withstand the storms, and it's productive, and it gets these terrific 8-inch ears of corn that I get that are just filled out to the tip with kernels, and it is just beyond like a flavor. You can eat it, you can almost eat it raw, really. And I just bring them in the house and steam them for just a couple of minutes just to bring out a little bit of the flavor even more. And I don't put butter on them. I don't put salt on them. I just eat them plain, and it is like the best.
Well, you know, it's funny. You said you could eat it raw, and people don't know that because, you know, we fish with my cousin Jimmy Toots. And Jimmy and I, growing up on the farm, we would just go out and pick some fresh corn and just eat it right. Actually, eat it right in the field because it was that good right there. So you can eat it raw. Everyone cooks it, and that's fine, but that's something. Now, going to the organic garden, you gave some seed to your neighbor. Why?
My neighbor is right behind me. He's only maybe 100 feet or so, his garden away from mine. And the type of corn that I grow, and again, there's so many corns, I can't believe there's so many varieties when you open the catalog. And I've tried a number of them through the years. But this particular type requires isolation for pollination purposes, because if there's other corns in the area that are not of the same hybrid or the same variety, they can cross-pollinate with the bees and the wind and everything that moves pollen around. And if that happens, then the corn will not pollinate the same way that it needs to for the super sweet. So it'll be contaminated, basically, is probably a way to put it. And it'll revert to a pig corn, basically. It won't be well, it won't taste well, and it won't fill out nicely. So by doing this, it's like, it's kind of the method to my madness. I provide my neighbor with the free seed, and he loves the corn too. And it also ensures that both of us have isolated varieties so that we can get the maximum potential from our corn. And then we also stagger that too. Like every 2 weeks or so, we'll put a block of corn in. So we stagger the corn harvest so we don't get it all at one time.
No, that is a great thing in itself. And you and I on past shows, you would always talk about how the importance of just sharing your crop with someone. So if you have extra beans, you're giving off to a neighbor or a friend or a family member. And now you're giving seed, and there's a definite advantage to sharing that seed with your neighbor. So moving along in the garden, and I've got to say this, we're going to talk about your varieties of squash, but it's almost, I don't know, it's like, I'll use my made up word, dinosaur-iferic. Some of the leaves on some of your squash are the largest leaves I've ever seen on squash. So tell me about your squash this year.
Okay, we grow two types of squash out there. The first is our summer squash, or zucchini type squash, that most people know them as. So we grow what's called Zephyr squash. And you're starting to see these more at farmers markets a little bit too. It's a yellow and green on the same fruit. So it's a really pretty one. It's mostly yellow, so it makes it really easy to find when you're going to pick it. And then you have the green on the end there. And this is a hybrid too. It's a triple hybrid. It's got crookneck squash, which is a yellow zucchini, crossed with a delicata squash, which is a winter squash, and also crossed again with an acorn squash. So this is a, to me, I've been growing it now for several years. It's super productive. Like I said, the plants are gigantic in terms of the leaves. So they get a lot of sun and they seem to be disease resistant. And also because of the attributes of the winter squash that are in there, it helps to make the vine resistant to squash vine borers, which are the bane of everybody that's trying to grow squash. That's like a yellow, or actually an orange and black critter that comes in, flies in, and he injects eggs and stuff into the stem of the plant, and that wilts the plant and causes disease, and the plant can go from one day from looking like the best plant in the world to like the worst plant in the world. So they're very, very destructive. So these plants seem to have a natural resistance built into them. And I just like the flavor. It's a nutty flavor, buttery flavor. I pick them small, around 6 inches, and they're good raw. Again, you can eat them raw, little sticks or a dip, or you can cook them and put them in crock pots and whatever else you use your zucchini for, any zucchini recipe. And the idea of these is you don't let them go to the big, you know, foot long, 2 foot long zucchini where you have to start chasing the neighbors to take them from you. These are just small. They're made to be used small, and they're much, much more flavorful. So you don't get a lot of oversupply of zucchini. And I just put a couple in a couple of plants. I don't get crazy with those.
And the neat thing about that is, and you are correct, when people will pick their fruits smaller, their vegetables smaller, they're going to get two things. Because the plant, as you discussed before, is going to want to put out more seeds, so it's going to grow more of whatever you're growing. And the taste is definitely much better. You also grow a winter squash as well, correct?
Right. We grow what's called better nut. And it's actually a hybrid butternut squash. So it's a winter squash, the familiar tan-colored squash that we see in the stores in the fall with the orange flesh inside them. Again, I grow these. These are long-term, so these will grow on the ground underneath the corn. So I'm getting a double shot for that space that I had there, whereas as the corn's growing up and finishing, the squash now is taking off even more and spreading out among the corn growing up there. And the better nut, it's a hybrid variety I've been using now for several years. It pollinates well. It's very disease-resistant, and the flavor is just incredible. I have several people that I supply those to, and they said these are like the best butternut squash they've ever had because they're sweet, and when you cook them, you can just see the sugar. Even when you cut them open, the sugar just oozing out of them. They store well, and they're coming a variety of sizes, but generally they're like a one- or two-person size fruit that you get on there, so you're not overwhelmed with these gigantic pieces of squash fruit. And they clean up real easy. They store easy. They're easy to peel, and they're very easy to process. They have very small seed cavity too. So better nut hybrid. I like those the best.
It's funny that many years ago we had Chef Tariq cooking in your organic garden, and he took some of those, and he did some wonderful things on the grill with those. Things I learned how to peel them easily, and then after that, I learned how to cook them on the grill easily, and it just gave, once again, gives you another way to prepare some of the foods that you love so well.
Right. And the best thing is they keep, like, I'm still eating those in January and even into February. They're such good keepers. So my actual gap from, let's say, February to April is very short, where I always have something to eat out of my garden. I got the late stuff I stored, and then the early stuff, the peas and the lettuce, you know, start coming in, you know, April, May.
Nate, now, I know that over the last couple of years, you got away from some of the larger varieties of tomatoes. You want to discuss your tomatoes in your garden this year?
Yeah, this year, because I use the red mulch underneath and the type of caging we do, I get tomato plants that are just incredible. Even now, as I'm looking out at them, they're 5 and 6 foot tall. They've grown out of their cages already. It's just amazing. So I grow two, this year I have two cherry tomatoes, a red cherry tomato and a yellow cherry tomato, and then I have a moderate size little tomato in the middle. So the idea is that the smaller tomato, you get them much sooner because everybody sees the plants. Oh, when the tomatoes coming, the bigger your tomato, the longer you have to wait for it to ripen and get that good tomato taste going. So by growing the smaller ones, I can actually start picking them pretty early. Generally, I can start picking them in July, like mid-July, mid to the third week of July, I'll start picking them. And then once they start coming, then they're just inundated. So I'd only put three plants in now because, again, it becomes a problem of distribution because there's so many coming at once and trying to harvest them.
No, that's one thing that you are correct. The volume of tomatoes out of your garden over the last couple of years, and with the cherry ones, because they're so small, as you discussed, they just keep cranking out. And it's almost like you come back every single day in your garden, tomatoes and cucumbers are like magically, like you pick them in the morning, you come back at night, and you're going, wait, where'd these things come from? And it's like they grow that quick. Like really, utterly amazing on that one.
Yeah, now, the variety that I grow is indeterminate. Also, see, there's two types of tomatoes, determinate and indeterminate. And I grow the indeterminate, which implies it's going to keep growing like forever, you know, until the frost gets it or, you know, something else takes it out. But so if you want long, productive plants, indeterminate's the best. If you only have a small amount of space, though, determinate is better because you can grow them in buckets or pails on your patio or on your front steps. And they're a smaller plant, but they will grow and they'll just produce a certain amount of fruit and then they're done. So they're determined. So it's a determinate plant.
Now, how about your cucumbers? And last year, your cucumbers, it was like I just discussed, it was utterly amazing. You'd pick in the morning, I'd be there, you know, coming into your garden with you or stopping by. And in the evening, your vines were filled up 100%. So can you tell me about your cucumbers?
Yes, last year was like totally insane, the amount of cucumbers. We probably got over 400 cucumbers off the rack. Like you said, in the morning we'd pick them and go out at night and there's 12 more to pick. It's like I never knew something could grow that fast. So I grow what's called a Diva cucumber, D-I-V-A. And it's a parthocarpic type cucumber. These come out of the Middle East and that's where they originated from. And they're designed to be a female-only cucumber. So they have flowers just like regular thing. They look like a regular cucumber, but there's no male flowers involved at all for pollination. I don't quite understand even now how that works, but it works like really well. The plants are very disease-resistant. They have, and the productivity is just incredible on them, and the plants are very, very aggressive. So you have to have a lot of space to grow them up on a rack and, you know, keep tucking them in and getting them going. But they do very well. As long as you keep them fed, you know, with maybe a little boost fertilizer mid-season. And then also just watch for disease and all that.
Now, tell me about your peppers, because I actually grow a few peppers of my own in your garden. So tell me about what you have going on this year.
Okay, the peppers we have out here this year are from chilipeppers.com from the nursery. And we have Hungarian sweet wax. We have blushing beauty. And then we have a hybrid that's like a giant green. I just call it Big Bertha. That's not the real name of it. But it's a big, giant green pepper. That it looks, it's beyond photogenic. When you grow one of these and you look at it, so it just can't be a real pepper. It is so perfect and so smooth and so huge. So I grow all three types, again, to stagger my harvest. So I have different peppers that mature at different times. The Hungarian sweet wax is like a small banana pepper for frying and for raw eating and salads. And that just, it's incredibly productive. So we only put two of those plants in. We'll probably get 80 or 100 peppers off of that. The blushing beauty is a good sweet eating pepper for raw. All peppers are good raw, and then but they're good cooked too for people who do the cook thing with peppers. And then the big guys, they're just so big, so you really get a giant pepper out of that. So you're doing a crock pot or a big dish somewhere, it gives you just a lot of flesh to deal with on the pepper. But we like them a lot. We grow them in cages also, and they're just so productive.
Now, one of the things that you and I were discussing last night with your blushing beauties, and again, they turn, or supposedly turn red. We've always noticed over the last couple of years in your garden that when you allow them to get to that red stage, they go bad quickly, correct?
Yeah, they do. I can't quite figure that out, why that's happening. Could have something to do with the water possibly or the sun. But so I have to watch them really close. Like if I can get one to blush, sometimes I get them to blush late in the season. But the early ones, if we try to let them go red or to get the blush, then they tend to go bad on the vine before that happens.
But the neat thing is, before they blush, they taste super that way. So, and you're picking at that point, and that's right. Fine. And people also need to understand that when you pick peppers, especially when they turn colors, they will have different colors, different flavors. And if you're doing hot, they'll have different amounts of heat also during that. Now, the fun story I told last year was I had one of your green bells, the perfect large guys, in my cooler. Gabby and I are going fishing. I pull out two apples, but as I'm pulling the apples, she looks in the cooler and sees one of your peppers, and she loves bells. And she goes, "Could I have that?" I said, "Sure." And she picked it up. First time I ever saw a kid pick up a bell pepper and eat it like an apple. It was just like, it was probably just like one of the cooler sights. And she obviously loved your peppers as well. Really neat. Just a neat story about those. Now, moving along to your eggplant, tell me about those.
So eggplant, we grow those because we like the flavor of those, and we can use them in different things, in quiches and egg crock pots, and just cooked up, you know, make a little eggplant rotolatini out of them. So eggplants are notoriously difficult to grow for a lot of people. They're very fussy about their weather conditions, their moisture requirements. They're a very heavy feeder, so you have to make sure you keep them well fertilized. And they are subject to disease and other pests that come in. So you have to watch them really closely. But what I've done now is I grow a smaller type eggplant. Rather than trying to grow the big monster eggplants, which the longer it's on the vine, the more chance that something's going to go wrong. I grow a smaller, it's called a millionaire plant variety, millionaire. And there's a lot of them that have there. It's just a smaller 6-inch slender type eggplant, and they're very, very productive, and they come early. I've already been picking those, wow, probably the end of June we started picking those, and they were only planted in mid-May. So you think about, they were planted mid-May, and we got them, you know, within a month and a half, we were starting to pick them already, and they're coming on strong. We're picking a lot of those, and the plants already look like kind of shaky looking, like it's like, ah, we're not really happy to plant, but they're still producing. They get beautiful purple flower, and they get the purpley black fruit on there, and it's just incredibly smooth, thin skin. And eggplants, you can pick those at any size as long as the skin is shiny. That's the point. You can start to pick them. If you need some small ones right away for a meal you're making, you pick them as long as they're shiny, or you can let them go a little longer and they'll stay shiny, and then you pick them both. And they store pretty well, you know, because they're fresh. Again, just got to watch the thorns on top. Some of the eggplants have thorns up around where they're on the stem. So be careful with that.
And this show is brought to you by Ramsey Outdoor Stores. Whether you shop online or in one of their stores, your experience will successfully gear you up for your next adventure. Go to RamseyOutdoor.com. Now, Inspector Dave, in the garden, we just spoke about the good. Now, I don't want to call it the bad, but there are things that we just need to control. So can you tell me about pest, disease, and critter control in your garden?
Well, I was thinking back when we had a very mild winter overall across the country, and I'm thinking already in advance, like, that means that there's going to be a lot more critters around this year because there was no winter die-off with the hard snows and ice and coldness, and food supply was readily available. So I figured there's going to be an explosion of critters this year. And boy, was I right. There are just chipmunks everywhere, groundhogs everywhere, squirrels everywhere. You know, all the critters that love to come into the garden and dig around and bite your plants and dig things up that you're trying to plant. So we knew pretty early on that it was predictable. And we're also seeing it with, just like we saw the bees come in, the good things, but the bad things too is that some of the other insect pests too that overwinter in your garden or in the garden waste and all that, they too survived the winter because they were not. So we have a more advanced invasion of little pests that either flying in, crawling in, walking in, or whatever. So we have to think about all lines of attack now and lines of defense, you know, to control ourselves. And remember, we're working organically, so we're not going to pick up a can of spray and just start spraying everybody and knocking everything down. You know, we're trying to be careful not to do that, like, ever. So one of the things we did, because we knew the ground pests were going to be difficult this year, is we did put up our shock fence. And a shock fence is just a wire. They use them for training dogs. They're not lethal or anything. It just gives a little nip to a critter that gets near there, whether it's a groundhog, a squirrel, whoever wants to come into the yard. And it helps to train them, just like you train your dog to stay in the yard or to stay in certain areas. It just gives them a little nip, and then they run away and they know, okay, we won't go in that area. So we put the perimeter fence up very early this year, just to start getting everybody trained, all the critters trained, not to go in there. And it's, you know, it's work to put it up, then it's work to climb over it every day and, you know, maintain it and all that kind of stuff. But it was so critical this year. If I didn't have that, I'm sure the garden would have been decimated very early on by the groundhogs and the squirrels and chipmunks and raccoons and skunks and everybody that likes to come in there. The only good animal that comes around is the possum, actually, because he helps to clean up a lot of the little bugs around. They eat like small mice, and they also go after small insects and all that. So they're, or if you see possums around, that's good. You want to treat them. They're your friends. They're what they call the butler of the garden. You want to make sure that they're okay, and the babies, you know, you leave the babies alone and all that. They're ugly looking as far as they're not the most beautiful animal in the world, but boy, they do a great job for us. So we want to, you know, keep them as our friends.
It's funny. So, I never heard the term butler of the garden. I like that.
Yeah. That's it. Clean things up for us. So we talked about that. Another thing we had was on the cucumbers this year, I noticed I was getting some damage fairly early on, and the plants weren't robust like I expected them to be. They really got a slow start this year. And as I started to delve into it a little bit more, I saw we were under attack from cucumber beetles, both striped and spotted cucumber beetles. And they were just like all over. Usually you get a few of them here and there, but they were just like incredible. So I already had some sticky traps, yellow sticky traps with a lure, a pheromone lure and that goes with it. And you hang them near the garden away from the cucumbers to draw them away. And they get drawn over to the lure, and then they get stuck to the yellow plastic as like a sticky glue on it. And we caught a ton of those like very early on. So it was a bad invasion this year. Yet my neighbor had none on any of his cucumbers. It was really weird. They stayed away from him, but they came after mine. So we just caught dozens of those. Then we put a little diatomaceous earth, garden variety of that, not the stuff for your pool. That's different diatomaceous earth, but garden variety diatomaceous earth. We put that around the base of the plant. So any eggs that were dropped down there or juveniles that sprouted up there, the diatomaceous earth would scratch their skin and they would dehydrate and we'd be done with them. Good for cutworms too. They all soak and go after small plants. And we put a little bit of that up on the end on the lead growth too, some diatomaceous earth there, because they would go after that very, very tender new growth there. So it was a good way to wipe them out there. So I think I got them under control now. I ended up putting three separate traps up this year, which is incredible that we had that much stuff. But again, it's you have to should visit your garden every day, see what's going on, checking plants, checking health, checking pests, seeing what happened during the night, what didn't happen, and harvesting and all. So you got to get out there and check.
No, and actually, as you're saying that, that's also the enjoyment of is getting out to your garden every single day, because besides working the soil or the plants, there's peace there. There's birds, there's butterflies, there's bees. Like there's all this going on, and it's just an enjoyable time, especially, you know me, I'm the morning guy. It's just super enjoyable time in the morning. Now, if you don't mind, we can move along here. There are some important factors, whether you have an organic garden or not, and hopefully people are making the jump over to organics because it's simpler, it's easy, and it's less expensive. And again, and the real answer is, and it's healthy for your body. Well, some of the important factors is you do staggered plantings. Explain that a little bit, please.
For the staggered planting, when you get your seed packages in and your plants also, but mostly more with your seeds because we direct seed a lot of our plants, the whole packet doesn't have to be planted. A lot of people think, oh, I got a whole packet. I got to put all these seeds in. Like, no, you put some of them in now and then put some of them in like a week or two or three later, and a week or two or three later after that, and that'll stagger germination of the seed, and you probably may hit better weather conditions somewhere within that time period, so you get maximum germination and maximum growth of that particular plant. So some of the early ones may do better than some of the later ones, or vice versa. And it also will help to spread out the harvest. So as the plants mature, they don't all mature at once. So you get inundated with that particular fruit that you're picking. So it's a great way just to spread out so you get long-term harvesting. Because you can, I plant well in halfway into my season here. I'll plant into July, even early August, I'll put some seeds in the ground, and we'll get a late type of weather. We get some warm weather, and that'll help to those plants to grow. They won't grow as fast and be as super productive, but they will still grow, and you'll still get harvesting, you know, from them. So it's very, very important to harvest. But the main thing to take away there is you don't have to plant the whole packet when you go out there.
That is, yeah, and that is a common thing, especially for the rookie gardeners who are out there. And I noticed this year you're taking a number of photographs in the garden, and what does that help you with?
Well, but a few things. It gives me opportunities to share my garden's pictures on social media, you know, and with the Joey B website here, Joey B TV website. It gives me a chance to get the pictures out there that hopefully will inspire people, boast a little bit, hey, here's where I'm growing, and to help give lessons to people. And it also gives me an opportunity to understand how I rotate my crops. So I'm keeping track of, even though my garden is not gigantic, I try to do some rotation of crops from year to year for soil health and disease control and pest control. And this reminds me of where I planted them. And it also helps me understand spacing. Even though I've been doing this for over 35 years, the spacing of plants is the number one challenge, I think, whether you're a rookie gardener or a super advanced gardener, just trying to space everything, knowing that you have this tiniest little seed that's going to grow into an humongous plant that takes 3 or 4 or 5 feet of space, you know, or a small plant that's 6 inches tall and is going to become 6 foot tall down the road, trying to plan for that so you don't overplant your garden so the plants are spread out, they don't compete with each other too much, and it helps to control the spread of disease.
And I think that's the simple mistake of rookie gardeners, never knowing like how large your squash is going to grow out there and cover and grow into your grass or wherever out of your garden. So that spacing is super important. And we just had Tropical Storm Fay come through here in the Northeast. And tell me about, you know, what do you do in preparation knowing a storm is coming?
Well, certainly we have to get our rain barrel situation all squared away so we're ready to maximize our harvesting of the rainwater. So we want to empty what barrels we can, move water around to the outer barrels, and then try to, you know, at least stockpile as much water as possible. And then we always talk about building strong for our garden. So when we're putting up trellises or we're putting up cages for our tomatoes or racks for our cucumbers, it's when you're doing a tiny little plant and you build this like humongously heavy duty structure, you're building for the future. So you want to make sure you're making your garden storm ready, because you can get any kind of storm, whether it's a tropical storm, just a severe thunderstorm during the summertime, a windstorm. A lot of things can destroy your garden pretty quickly in a matter of minutes, actually, if you get a strong 50 mile an hour wind or something. So we try to make our garden as strong as we can, try to grow it so there's some wind breaks around in the yard. We have trees planted on the outer perimeters to help control the wind a little bit. And you just want to make sure that you're building, like, don't put up a little tiny little quarter inch little pole or dowel to try to hold your tomato plant. You need something substantial. The plant alone is going to be heavy and big and put a lot of stress once the fruit starts setting, but you really, really want to plan for the weather, for the wind primarily there. And you're thinking about sun too when you're planting. If you're going to get 30 days of direct sun, that you have your plants stagger, so the higher things are in the north and the lower plants are in the south, so you're not shading. Some of the plants aren't being shaded out, not getting the maximum from that sun. So that's, you know, a big part of it too.
Yes, and that also gets back to your planning and your spacing, what you spoke about before, and having, and I know that you, I guess a great place to end is you have a notebook that you keep notes on your garden about the pros and cons of what's gone on And then the last thing you always say, and I love this, that your garden is an experiment because every year you are experimenting.
Yes, that's correct. Then the blue mulch is the big project this year on the cucumbers there. We're trying that out. Seems kind of unnatural having a blue mulch out there, but yeah, we're giving it a shot there. Harvesting is so, actually there's more work involved now this time of year harvesting. Harvesting is probably a busier time than the actual planting time because it's constant. You got to be out there like every day or every other day. You got to get out there early before the sun's out there in between storms while the plant is producing well. So harvesting is a huge part that does take a lot of time. So you got to make sure you plan your day accordingly.
That is. Now, Inspector Dave, as usual, you're a great friend, and I just want to thank you for coming on the show today because you taught us so many great things and gave us great tips on how to garden in the organic garden.
Okay, thanks for having me. I just so welcoming your show and the fact you give me an opportunity to share what I know with people and all that. That's what life's all about, sharing our knowledge and our everything good in our lives with everyone else.
I thank you very much. And until next time, enjoy life's adventures.
You can follow all of my adventures online at joeybee.tv. That's joeybee.tv. And a very special thank you to the men and women of our armed forces for keeping us free and for our police and firefighters for keeping us safe. May God bless America. Until next time, this is Joey B. Enjoy life's adventures.